Hello, it's a beautiful morning here at Holden Village. Today, inside here at the Koinonia building, is Ted Grosser, and he's going to speak on Charity Begins at Home. And so let's go to the fireside room now and join Ted.
Let me, as I do with each group, just kind of introduce the context within which I'm coming out of. And that is, I had an international children's organization. We have programs in about, not in about, we have programs in 16 countries, five of which are in the United States, and some of them double up. Some, we run primarily schools and medical clinics. We work with children and families. Primarily, we do some work with orphans. Our biggest projects are overseas, are with about 10,000 children who are victims of Chernobyl and the meltdown and dealing with all of that. That is probably going to be displaced very quickly by a project in Uganda, where we are going to be looking at working with that portion of about 25,000 children who have been orphaned by AIDS. And we will be looking and working with those children who are neither affected with AIDS or who are HIV positive. Our biggest program here in the United States is in South Central Los Angeles, where we're working in a part of Los Angeles where there are about 400,000 people. And that probably is a good time to tell you that we are, while Children's Aid is in fact controlled by Lutherans, and the scary part is we have three Lutheran clergy on the board, you know, including me. But we are really an ecumenical organization. In South Central Los Angeles, we're working with a National Baptist or African American Baptist. In other parts of the world, in Indonesia, we're working with, for instance, the Church of God. In the jungles of South Burma, we're working with the Karens, who have their roots really in the Baptist Church. In places like Guatemala, Mexico, and Kenya, we even work with Lutherans. We also work with in Kenya with a group that is Dutch Reform / American Baptist, and they're now called the African Inland Mission, which is primarily not controlled by Africans, and the Americans who are working there work for them. In Eastern Europe, we work with Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and the Lutheran Church in Poland. And if you didn't know it, there's 100,000 Lutherans in Poland. They represent 1/10 of 1% or something like that, because 98% of the country is Roman Catholic. The context out of which I come is attempting to apply the gospel in real nuts and bolts ways that minister to the needs primarily of children and then their families, because you can't separate the two. The other primary place I come from is that it is absolutely essential to have a working understanding of the grace of God at work in my own life and in the lives of the people with whom I both work and serve. And the reason is the chances of failing when you are trying to minister and serve the needs of other people are so great that if you aren't constantly reminded that God forgives you, you get paralyzed and you can't do anything. Okay? That's basically the context out of which I want to come. This morning I want to start by reading a section out of the Gospel of John, and starting at the 12th verse. All I got to do is find it. Mm-hmm. There we go. It says, "I tell you the truth, if you believe in me," this is Jesus speaking now, "you'll do the works I am doing, and you'll do greater works than these, because I am going to the Father, and I will do anything you ask in my name, in order that the Son may glorify the Father. If you ask me for anything in my name, I'll do it. If you love me, you will do what I order. And I will ask the Father, and he will give you another Comforter to be with you forever. He is the Spirit of Truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it doesn't see or know him. You know him because he lives with you and lives with you and will be with you. To think about primarily the whole concept of love. The theme that we're going to be following today is that charity begins at home, and my premise is that that is not a very good Christian statement, okay? Primarily, you can't find it in one Bible passage, okay? And when I had more money, I offered groups, you know, if you find a thing, I'll pay you. Nobody collected, but I don't have any money anymore, so we're just going to let it go at that. I would say that more often than not, I hear this when somebody doesn't want to do anything. Okay? I also hear it very often from people who have a real mixed up view of both what the world is and what we as God's children are supposed to be about. Okay? And I guess what I would tell you that I've been doing this since 1965. And in those years, I have seen the world get smaller and smaller. I'm not a good artist and it's not centered. But the point I want to make is that we live in a really small world. If you looked at the bulletin board, I travel on average 250,000 miles a year. That's a lot. I'm 75% of the time on the road. Okay? But I will come home, and I will be home after I will have been here 2 weeks on Saturday. We'll go home, and 4 days later, I will get on a plane, and I will be in the Philippines in less than 1 day. Okay? I will come home, and I will be home for about 7 days, and then I will go to Africa, or we will go to Kenya, Somalia, and then Uganda. And then part of the group I'm with will come back to the States, and I will go on to 4 countries in Eastern Europe. Okay, it'll be about Labor Day. The point is that it isn't that tough. By the way, the difference between going this amount of miles and say going, let's say 20,000 miles a year, is that I don't prepare as long and pack as long. Okay, I have a couple of things my wife calls my go clothes, and I just grab them and go. It's really a very, very small world, okay? What happens, if you will, in Somalia affects what goes on in Holden Village, okay? Or the families around there in the United States. What happens in Rwanda, okay, affects us, or it should. When you have economic things, and I have watched now with real kind of fascination, because I didn't believe it would happen, that the Soviet Union has just collapsed and communism is halfway on a run, okay? But what happens there, and it happens in one part of the world, and over here you got businessmen rushing around trying to get organized in the United States, or roar over there and beat the Japanese, who are also packing and rushing, okay? And the Germans, and so on. And they're all going because they see opportunities. And some of them see more opportunities than I do, because I think it's going to take a very long time for what was the Soviet Union to really get settled down and, in fact, be a real viable market for us. But the fact is, and I can't drive it home enough, you and I are affected by what happens all over the world. And movements like Buy American, okay, are really neat PR stuff. They are a big joke. Okay? You wanna know why? I at one point, because I had a board member just pressing the daylights out of me, we gotta buy American. And kind of the next report in front of the board meeting was, we need some new computers. Okay, hard. What is more American than IBM? You know where the guts of IBM's made? China, but also Japan. Okay? and they're assembled in Mexico. Okay? And you sit back and you say, well, what's American about it? And it turned out to be the case, you know, the outward case. The fact is, and I'm not knocking that, I happen to think that such an integrated world is a good thing. I think ultimately it means that we are going to be, because the businessmen will control some of this, we are not very likely to go to war with the suppliers of our parts of our IBM machines or whatever, okay? Or our cars. The fact is that we live in a very, very interwoven, intertwined world. And to think we can somehow separate that and pull it apart isn't real anymore. It really isn't, okay? So that's part of the whole thing, which is to say that charity begins at home, and have we agree with you that that's a good statement, gets down to what is, in fact, home. Mm-hmm. And if you agree that the planet is our home, then I'm all for what you're saying, okay? If we were to look at ministry, okay? Obviously, you picked up the wrong one. It's ministry as part or equals part of mission, okay? If you'll let me do that for a minute. I think part of what we struggle with, and particularly what Lutherans struggle with, is the same problem that the very first Christians did, which is they wanted, and they focused the initial spreading of the gospel at home, in Jerusalem, Judea, and the surrounding countryside. And it took some real a kind of shaking by God, initially with Peter, and then when Paul came along and blew the whole thing up, okay? To say that the gospel of Jesus Christ is for the whole world, and it needs to go out to the whole world. And I think very often that what we do by way of ministering to other people is pretty much the same thing, okay? And if we do this, we need to be shaken, just as the early followers of Jesus were shaken, to see a whole world view as an absolutely an essential ingredient in our ministry to the world. Let me just look at some notes here quick, okay? Because I think my neighbor. Huh? Who is your neighbor?
Everybody.
Yeah. The problem is that we like to think of our neighbor as the guys who look like us and the women who look like us. They're the neighbors we feel the most comfortable with. But let me tell you a real personal story. We have four older kids. They're not kids anymore. The youngest, my wife reminded me when I said kids the other day, was 29. Okay, we go to 36. We have four grandchildren. And for a whole number of reasons that I won't get into in any detail, a little over 7 years ago, we were talking about possibly wanting to think in terms of adopting. Okay? We had worked in Guatemala for a very long time and had asked a friend to send, who was going down to Guatemala, that if you found any kind of openings for children to be adopted, let us know, and we would look into it. Well, the turkey sent us back a note via postcard. If you know anything about international mail, by the time the postcard got us, these kids were grown, were off wherever they were going to go. So after the postcard came, my wife called out of Guatemala, being an eternal optimist, and she was talking with the woman who was supposed to be the contact who could possibly set up an adoption with these things. And it was in the most earliest stages that you could possibly imagine, okay? I mean, this is something we had thought about, talked about, seen a guy at a cocktail party and said, hey, if you see anything, you know, do something. And then we forgot it. Then the Coast Guard came and Janet, my wife, said, okay, I'll call. She calls down there. And then, as happens, she got really into this whole business, you know? And was really getting crushed as the first situation was no longer available. And the second situation was no longer available. And then the third situation was no longer available. And the woman said, my goodness, Mrs. Grosser, you sound really disappointed. And Janet said, yeah, I am. And I said, wait a minute, Grosser, did you guys have anything to do? This is 1987, was this conversation. Did you have anything to do with the earthquake, which is 1976? And my wife said, yeah, well, my husband directed the medical relief at that time for the country. And the woman said, that makes everything different. My brother's alive because of one of the hospitals that your husband had people in and so on. She says, what you do is you call us tomorrow morning with the name for a child, and the child was born this morning, and you can register the child, okay, with your name right away. And Janet hung up, and she comes down the hall, and she said, man, this is an absolute miracle. You know, this is just moving so fast. And she said, we just got to pick this a name for the baby and call and then get the thing going. I said, well, are we picking a boy's name or a girl's name? She said, damn, I forgot to ask. And had a call back and so on, okay? And the Elizabeth is running around here, okay, 7 years old. And the whole thing, by the way, we were able to move her over to friends right away, but we were totally unprepared. There's a whole bunch of legal hoops you have to go through that we didn't know about when we were just thinking about this. And I've asked my wife to stop drinking at cocktail parties so that she's more sensible when she tells friends to look at these things, okay? But the fact is that what has happened is an absolutely transforming thing for us. Because I can stand and I can tell you how many children die every single day from malnutrition and starvation. And go up the number, it's 40,000 a day, 15 million a year, okay? 15 million is half of the people in the state of California where I live. Take a line at Santa Barbara, you just wiped out all the people south of that line every year, okay? Every single year. And I can get you real into that, okay? But nothing has, and I have visited places. I have worked in Somalia, and I've worked in Ethiopia, and in places like Guatemala, and other places where there were great, great tragedies, either man-made through war or natural tragedies. But nothing has driven home the truth that we are all God's children, as much as Elizabeth. And anybody who comes up to me and says, boy, is Elizabeth ever lucky, you know, to be in America, to be in your home, and so on. I said, no, you're really wrong. You're really totally wrong. Janet and I are the ones who are really blessed by this child. You know, and sometimes it grinds at me because she's bright and she's real outgoing, and I wish we could take credit for that, but we can't. So. But it's also a real reminder that we are really all part of God's family. And the fact is, we took this child who came out of a country where almost half of the children die before they're 5 years old. Okay? And she's had good health care, she's had a neat home and some loving parents, and she's had great stimulation in school. And she's a living example of why we need to be moving out and caring about children throughout the world. We really do, okay? Because I not only see it in her, I see it in other kids who are in our schools that our organization runs. I see it in children and then later adults who are the benefits of the efforts of many organizations and the branches of the church. if ever you get the point where you think that there is no good thing happening in this world, call me up. Take one of these things and call me up and say, Ted, I need a little encouragement, you know? Because I will encourage you. I've been in this thing long enough to see the numbers of children that die cut in one half of what they were about 29 years ago, okay? I've lived long enough and been in this thing long enough to know that now there is absolutely no justifiable reason under God for people to go hungry, whether in this country or in any other country, okay? Because we have enough food and we produce enough food and we have enough food in storage that if we ever get the political will to distribute it to just help people and not play political games, we can do it, okay? And if we ever get to that point, we won't send the Marines into a place like Somalia just to fatten them up long enough so that they can get killed by somebody else. And that's what we've really done. Because what we really need to be doing is when we see people as our neighbors, we need to see them as people who are A, God's people, just like you and I, and B, entitled to all of the respect that God's people is entitled to. Three, that what we do with real integrity. Not so much counting on what's going to happen at the end, okay? That we work on a process that has real integrity to it, okay? And I know, and I've said this in other classes, that all of us are really, at times, really troubled by the fact that we can't figure out where our money's going to go. Okay, and there are enough people running off with money. There are enough people wasting it. There are enough people calling you up for the police protective society and giving 99% of it or 98% of it to their fundraising stuff and very little to the policemen. And so we've got all kinds of reasons to worry and wonder whether our money's going to go someplace. Okay. And we do it right down to the guy who tries to hustle you on the corner. They may not do that in Washington, it's maybe just a wonderful place. But let me tell you, all over California, they hustle you. And I spend about 1 week out of every 7 in Washington, D.C., and these guys have become more aggressive than New Yorkers, you know. And every time you wonder whether or not if you give them a buck or whatever, that are they just, you know, hoarding it up in their pockets so they get enough to go buy a bottle, or they're really going to go get some food or whatever. I am not certain that that's a question we should be asking at times, okay? There's a Muslim saying that you need the beggar way more than the beggar needs you, okay? Because you need the beggar to demonstrate that God's love is at work in your heart and in your life. And that you're going to be a good steward of what you have. That you're going to share it. And, excuse me, from both a Christian and a Muslim point of view, okay, you never know when you're going to meet God in that beggar, okay? You never know when Christ is going to reveal himself as you serve the needs of a little one. Which is promised. You know, what you do to the least of these, you do what?
You do
to me. Okay? And so there's an opening and an opportunity that we better not overlook, I think. Okay? And I also think that there is a presumption that people think they know and can control what the end is. And I don't know how your life works. My life doesn't work that way. Okay? And as I say very often, I make this very clear list of my plans and I give them to God. And God doesn't seem to pay much attention. God seems to have another set of plans, another agenda for me. And that my job is not so much to plan so carefully to know where I'm going to end up, but to have real integrity in the process moving from point A to point B. You understand what I mean by that? What might this mean? Integrity in the process. Yeah, go ahead.
Honesty, integrity means honest.
Okay. Okay, honesty.
Compassion.
Compassion.
Thoughtful.
Thoughtful.
I would think motive would come into that.
Motive. Great. Okay. Motive. Okay. Stop here, so. What else? What you got here is, in fact, the outline of what makes for a very good approach to serving the poor wherever. Okay? Then, in point of fact, you do this honestly, and you look at the situation as honestly as you possibly can to determine what the needs are, but also what the assets are. And then you figure out what really can be done. Nothing is crueler, I think, than to promise someone some help that you don't deliver on. And it's real easy to do that. It's real easy to do that any place in the world. I was going to say at first, nah, it's easier in the third world because they have so much. And so, but I want to tell you something. It is as easy to do it in downtown Seattle or Los Angeles or San Diego or wherever you are. Okay? Because, friends, you do not have to tell somebody that is suffering from some kind of addiction that they got problems. That is not news to them. Okay? What you might be able to tell them, if you've got some compassion, is that there is hope. And there's, if you have it, and Jody Pressman is about ready to go. I think he's got a session today. If there's some way you can get to it, go to it, okay? Jody's got the most wonderful overlay. He works with collecting stories of successes in cities around the United States. And one of the wonderful things, he's got one overlay that has all the negative stuff you can imagine. Okay? Okay, it's you know, there are gangs in the inner city, there's people on welfare, illegitimate pregnancies, drugs, just all of the, you know, I don't even have to go over the list. I see some of you just shaking your head, I know what he's talking about. But what he's saying is that this overlay of negative stuff, which is absolutely essential as you create a needs statement for a grant, for instance, or in your own head. Does this person really need to be helped? You know, you do not need a scientific study if someone is homeless, mentally ill, and addicted to know that something needs to be done. All right? And closing your eyes will not help. But the fact is that if this negative stuff, okay, is all you ever look at, it's kind of like, and I don't know if we hear it as much as we used to. When I first got out of school, for instance, you would talk to young people and say, I'm not going to church anymore. All these guys are doing is, you know, hellfire and brimstone and just beating us over the head. And I'm not going to hear that anymore. Okay? And so we've softened that up. And I don't mean that in a negative, terrible sense. We have discovered that you can probably do as much by focusing on the grace of God and the power of God to make us into new. We found that by focusing on the fact that when you're forgiven and Christ covers that, okay, you have every opportunity for a brand new life out here. And suddenly you need to be looking at what are your assets to do good things. What are your strengths, not just your weaknesses?
And what Jody has another overlay,
he lays over here, that talks about all the positive things. And one of them that sticks out from yesterday, he says, well, we worked in this housing project where we're at one point, you could say from over here, we got 800 people on welfare. And go with all that stuff. But over here, he said, 800 people on welfare generate $7.5 million a year. What can you do with that? And there are things you can do. There are things that, if you focus on the plus, on the positive, on the assets of individuals and groups, you'll accomplish a whole lot more. And we in the church ought to be doing that. We really ought to. We ought to be the ones who are saying, hey, yeah, we realize all of these negative things are out there. All this garbage is in the air. But it is not hopeless because God transforms it. And I don't know if you've thought about it. I have, because of my travels and my work, been able to go all over the world and see interesting stuff. Cuba has not been able to import an American car since the end of the 50s. If you were to go to Havana today, you would see U.S. cars, vintage 1940s and 50s, working. These people are clever, you know. I got a 1991 car I can't keep going as well as these guys got, you know? But they're very, very clever. And all over the world you find this, that people, when they are really down, really suddenly tap into all kinds of creative stuff that they've done, and talents. And one of them that I keep mentioning is, and sometimes it's a matter of a point of view, I have for 3 years participated, because we host a workshop in Poland on developing basic community leadership. And they started out talking about the fact that we don't have anything that can compare with what you do in the United States. You know, we don't know how to organize volunteers, we don't know how to raise money like you do, and so on. And as we got talking about it, we realized that they didn't know what they were talking about. Poland is a country that for over 200 years has been subjugated by one or another foreign power, that has had several attempts to have it wiped off the face of the earth. And all during those years, they have had one of the most effective undergrounds in the whole world. Okay? And it was well financed. And if one of the members of their underground got hurt, they could zip them off and they would get medical care, food, they could. And I saw this because I visited a couple places before the last revolution where they could turn out a passport that would make a U.S. immigration officer look 3 or 4 or 5 times. And these guys were good. And what we had, and what we're trying to, we had them started and we're working on getting them to see that they have some real assets. They just need to turn them around so that they're not directed at destroying the government, okay? Because at this point, they've done that. If they keep destroying the government, they're going to be shooting themselves in the foot and higher and higher and hurting themselves. But the fact is, there are assets in every single human being. And we in God's church ought to be dealing with those, all right? One of the things I want to do, and I handed this out, I'm going to hand out another one, because I want you to look at, you're going to have to share it. I've got one here. As we think in terms of this theme of charity begins at home, some of the things that we have to do is look at some real myths that we deal with. The first one being that there isn't enough food produced in the world to feed everyone. And I've already touched on that, but I want you to look at that thing, okay? In more depth after a while. There is, in fact, enough food. It's not distributed right, and it's all out of kilter, but in point of fact, there is the food. Myth number two, that hunger is caused by famine and natural disasters which cannot be controlled by people. That's totally wrong, okay? Most famine, as the one in Somalia, the one in Somalia was not caused initially by the drought that's in Africa, okay? It was caused by these little, what do you want to call them, warlords, I guess, you know, who in fact were killing each other off and making it totally unsafe and untenable to go out and work your fields. And that's what caused it. The truth of the matter is, Somalia was, until about 12 or 13 years ago, one of the great breadbaskets of all of Africa. And God willing, someday it will be again, okay? The starvation that's going on in Bosnia and Herzegovina and all of what was the former Yugoslavia, not caused by some natural disaster. And lots of it is, there was, right after the Soviet Union collapsed, you know, rumors going all over that people were going to starve to death in great numbers. And we have offices in Warsaw and in Belarus and Minsk, and then in Hungary, and they have contact with Moscow and so on. And the feedback we were getting is, don't send any food. And so then I went over there at one point and I said, what are you talking about? The newspapers are talking about these people going to starve to death. And the people who support our organization are going to say, these Children's Aid doesn't care about these kids, they don't care about adults, and what is this? And he said, well, wait just a little bit longer. And we waited a little bit longer, and what we found out was that there was in fact food. That in the breakdown of the Soviet Union, where the ruble became worthless, the farmers were not willing to send their food to the cities and be paid in rubles. Okay? What they were willing to do is, if the manufacturer, the manager of a plant that made radios, was willing to come and trade them so many radios for so many potatoes and cabbages, the guy could have all the cabbages and potatoes he wanted. And they went really back to a barter system. And in point of fact, very few people went hungry. That, first of all, you can make a mistake by rushing in with too much help too soon and not know where it's going. And the other thing is that the people do have a way, in very many cases, of knowing how to survive. Now, sometimes it gets out of hand, but in point of fact, it's there and there are assets. Number three is a biggie that I want you to look at, okay? Hunger is the result of overpopulation. If there were fewer people had fewer children, there would be fewer hungry people. I want to tell you just real quick that there is a more direct relationship between adequate health care, adequate education, and adequate economic opportunity. There's more of a relationship between those three and a drop in population than in distributing pills and all the other stuff, okay? If you would go back 100 years in the United States, the average family in the United States was 14 plus, okay? In fact, the average family had 17 live births 100 years ago, okay? By the end of World War II, when economic opportunity was pumping along, education was pumping along, and through the GI Bill really made kind of universal for a time, okay, and job opportunities and good health care, we were looking at 4 point something, okay? And now we had four kids in the late 50s and early 60s, and there are people who think I have worked to overpopulate the world, okay? Because now we're down to 3 point something. But this is what the pill contributed, if you will, okay? Not from 14 to 4. And that pattern has been repeated over and over and over throughout the world. So please remember that, okay? Also remember, it's a really complicated business because you have religious people, you got political folks, and so on, really just attacking you if you come in and talk about family planning. In Asia, for instance, we talk about child spacing. Okay. In Africa, we're talking about having a family which gives its children opportunities, and by implication, there are fewer so that you can give them the opportunities. Because you have either the religious thing, and that's not just Roman Catholics, okay? That's most fundamentalist Christians, and that's almost all fundamentalist Muslims. That's a religious thing, okay? Then you get over into the political thing, where if you mention in some countries, it is absolutely frightening what the political people will do. Then you get accused of genocide and a whole bunch of other stuff that just gets really bad news. Okay? Poor are unwilling to help themselves, or unable, or unwilling. I'm not even going to say anything about that. That is just a really outrageous, totally incorrect thing, okay? Number five, which really ties back to our theme for this morning, we need to take care of our own and poor people in the United States. We have the wherewithal to do that, okay? B, there are no poor people in the United States that compare with poor people in the developing world. There just flat aren't. 40,000 people, children, okay, die every single day from hunger, malnutrition, and childhood diseases. You want to know how many kids in the United States? This is per day around the world. A little less than 40,000 per year. Okay? That's 40,000 of the 15 million. And I don't want to take away the preciousness of this, I really don't, of these children. But man, let's get ourselves in some kind of perspective. Because what happens is that we roar up and down the streets burning whatever we want to burn to get the United States soldiers out of Vietnam. Okay? Because we had 50,000 die. And I don't want to take anything away from them, okay? Are you aware that 5 million Cambodians were slaughtered in the ensuing years, and not a single American protested? Do you know what's going on in Rwanda right now? We don't have anybody hitting the streets. And you want to know how the world sees us? As a racist, bigoted group of people. If our people are dying, man, we are going to do something. And if they're not ours, if they don't look like us, and they don't get into our definition of what a neighbor is, let them die. And I have traveled in enough countries and heard enough people, I can tell you that sentiment is not an isolated sentiment. And I don't believe it's a fair one. I also don't believe it's an accurate one for God's church. And we need to be out there, and we need to really be demonstrating that brothers and sisters of every people on the face of the earth are ours. And they're part of our family, okay? Okay, individuals cannot affect the hunger situation, only governments. Anybody in America who says that doesn't understand how their government works, okay? I spent enough time in Washington to know that if you're going to write your congressman or your senator, do it in longhand. Okay? Make it a little shaky. Nothing shakes up a congressman's office like a shaky handwritten letter from what they believe to be a little old lady from Iowa. Man. We got one, a real letter, you know? But the fact is that they do, in fact, read those. They are, in fact, influenced. Congressmen particularly, every 2 years their job is up, boy, and they want to be in tune with what's going on. If you have some concerns, and you have some real concerns about world hunger, join an organization like Bread for the World. We can't help you with that, okay? Bread for the World is, in fact, a lobbying organization. They'll give you model letters and so on to send to your congressman and so on. And they have affected great things. And they're not just worried and concerned about stuff overseas. their concern, for instance, about supplemental nutritional food for mothers on welfare and so on. What I want to do in the last couple of minutes is go back again to the fact that as God's church, we ought to be a message of hope throughout the world. We ought to be the ones who are saying, yeah, if you made a mistake, you can be forgiven. And that we ought to be the ones who also say, I know myself enough to know that I've blown it a whole lot and God's forgiven me. Life hasn't ended. In fact, new hope, new promises, new experiences have gone on. And sometimes we can't always see, to get back to the process. I had an experience where I was in an accident that took 2 years of my life with a bunch of surgeries. And if someone had come up to me in the middle of that and said, oh, things will be better than ever after a while, I would not have been amused, okay? I did have some guys, real helpful Christian-type friends, come up and say, do you think you're bad? You know, you should see the guy down the hall. I know you're not probably going to ever walk again, you know, but you should see this guy. That is no help, gang. Okay? No help at all. Those who reminded me that there are people in the hospital who have the same illness. One is totally bedridden and disabled and isn't going anyplace, and another one is trying to chomp at the bit and figure out how quick can I get out of here and get back on the job. Okay? The second one, who's focusing on strengths, who has hope, who has some dreams, that's the one that's going to get well. And that's what the whole story is throughout the Bible, of God's people and the people of the earth blowing it, and God calling that to their attention, sometimes in not real kind ways, but then offering forgiveness and renewal. And if I give you anything, keep that up there, take it home with you. Anybody got any questions or comments? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, America is the breadbasket of the world.
Mm-hmm. And
most of the farmers would give their wheat away if there was some way of transporting it from the field or the bin to any foreign country. The transportation is what eats the food supply being shipped out to other countries.
Transportation is a thing that can be overcome. Really can, because the governments and our own government do that. And while there are a lot of generous farmers, there are a lot of farmers who won't part with their subsidy, you know, under any circumstances. It's a kind of a mixed thing. But we are, in fact, the breadbasket of the world. We are, in fact, almost the most generous people on earth. Okay? We're not the most generous. Okay? If you just look at Russia alone, the Germans don't give us and just pure grants, 5-1. Okay? If you wanted to set up a program to help someone without any political agenda, go to Canada. Don't go near the United States government. The United States government and its foreign service does not give one penny away. This is not part of a political agenda. And if you think that foreign aid serves foreign people, look at it again, okay? For every $10 that goes out in foreign aid, 8 of it, by law, must be spent on American products and services. Mm-hmm. And you want to know what that means? If I have a project in a country that has its own airline, and that its own airline would give me a free seat, I can't use it. If I have a U.S. grant, I have to fly on an American flag carrier. Because foreign aid is not to help foreigners, guys.
It's a misnomer.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And that's not to say it doesn't do some good. Thank God the $2 left over can accomplish miracles in places. Because it really can. And the numbers of volunteers that go from the United States are, in fact, way more than any other country. But we're not the only ones who do it either, okay? The Dutch, for instance, are extremely generous people. The Germans, The French a little less, but also generous. So we don't have a lock on the thing. And that's not to knock it. That's what makes it possible to move this great big rock of poverty. Because there are a whole bunch of people in this world who realize that we live in a small globe that affects everybody else. Yeah?
This is probably kind of a dumb thing to ask, but
probably isn't.
Whenever you think of poverty nations, you think of India. And why don't they ever, it always seems they remain the same.
But they haven't. Mm-hmm. They really have not. When I was a child, my mother would jump between China and India, you know, when you didn't finish your milk. It was, think of all the poor children in India or China. And one day my sister went like this, and my mother said that, and she said, so send it. Let them have it, huh? The fact is, India has pretty much reached a point at this point, and has been for almost 10 years, where it's feeding all of its people. It really is. There's been tremendous progress in our ability to feed the world, okay? India, by the way, has also been, with Red China, the absolute most vicious or aggressive, however you want to look at it, in promoting birth control and forcing birth control. And the Indian government, a couple of them have fallen because they have a parliamentary system, and when they lose, have a vote of no confidence, that the government falls and they start over again. Two of them in the last 15 years have fallen over family planning and being too aggressive. Yeah?
The Santo Mission was started by the Norwegians a long time ago from India. Mm-hmm. But that became such a very prosperous part of India. Now, many of the national churches come out of the Santo Mission, and they specialize. The missionaries taught them how to raise tea, good tea.
Mm-hmm.
And they really became a force in India in a small group.
Oh yeah, Robert Mitchum, notwithstanding, missionaries, he gave missionaries a really bum rap. Missionaries have done some very, very good things throughout the world. They really have. As for preserving culture, I have never talked to someone, to a mother, let's say, in a remote village who said, don't immunize my child. We've never done that for 1,000 years. I don't want to start now. Let the child die. Never once in 29 years have I heard that. People want their children to live. They want to have hopes and dreams for them. Anybody else? Any comments?
Well, I know, just at our church, we make school kits and health kits and everything, you know, all different. We collect food and things. But some people would say, well, is that going to stay in our valley? You know, they're just so close.
Yeah.
To helping anyone, even out of our own little valley that we have. It's frustrating.
Yeah, it is. And no, I have a brother back in Wisconsin, and he and I, other than the fact we share a mother and parents and so on, have nothing in common. Okay? And it's a wonderful experience for me to go back and visit with Russ, who I love as my brother, okay? And his first thing, are you still dealing with this silliness overseas? You know, why? When he got out of the Air Force 25 years ago, he said, I don't need to fly anyplace else. You know. So the fact remains is that that is the sentiment. And we are recovering from a presidential campaign that was kind of an American first thing in lots of ways that was going to, you know, really say, well, we got to solve our own problems. And somehow we have worked ourselves into a state of mind in which the only thing there is an endless stream of money for was military stuff. You know, I don't know,
you weren't here last week, but I did a thing in the at lunch.
The Convention for Children's Rights, okay, 1990, the United States is the only developed country that has not signed it. One of the reasons is it says nothing about family planning, and we got all those people for whom family planning is the only thing they live for up in arms. And the other one is that it calls for $25 billion a year to provide health care, education, and economic opportunity for children. Do that, And they're saying that by the year 2005, we will essentially have solved probably 85% of the problems. The last 15% are going to take a long time because that last thing is... And they're screaming about this.
Let me tell you, if you take that by 10, okay, you get $2.5 trillion, huh?
That's how much the world spends in 1 year on military stuff. And if this isn't a disgrace before God and screwed up priorities, I don't know what is. Okay? We've long since reached the ability to blow everybody up umpteen times over. And if this is what we are currently spending a year.
But hasn't that been a problem throughout history? If you had a king, you had to raise an army, and the people would raise food for that.
Oh yeah, all I'm saying is we're a democracy though, guys. Write your congressman, if you think this is a screwed up priority, write him and tell him. If nothing else, he'll at least acknowledge your letter and avoid your house when he's canvassing the neighborhood. Thank you and God bless you.